And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
There is significant pain in the reality of unanswered prayer. I've had it in my life. I'm sure many of you will have had it in your lives too, that the pain of unanswered prayer is very real. But I just challenge a couple of things there, is that God arguably doesn't leave any prayer unanswered, but he doesn't necessarily give us the answer that we're looking for.
God makes a world in which love is possible. That's a world in which, as human beings, we're given the possibility of choice. That's what we see with Adam and Eve. But Adam and Eve have used their choice, as we have as human beings, to harm as well as to love.
I do think we shouldn't lose sight on the point that we're meant to be taking home from this, and that is the seriousness of God's judgment because of the seriousness of sin.
Hello and welcome to the Unbelievable podcast. I'm your host, Ruth Jackson, and today's show is a little bit different from our usual format, as I'm taking us back to one of the live Q&A events that we hosted in partnership with Spring Harvest. Joining us on the panel today is renowned public theologian and author, Dr. Emil Ewing, and two distinguished medical professionals, Dr. Ben Thomas, an international speaker and consultant anaesthetist from OCHA, the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, and Dr. Ben Chang, an A&E doctor, author and speaker. Our panellists answered questions which were submitted anonymously by young people and then voted for. We received questions on a plethora of different topics, including suffering, hell, prayer, sexuality, and whether the God of the Bible is a God of genocide. All of these are coming up in today's show. If you're new to the podcast, then please do hit the subscribe button to enjoy more content like this. And if you're watching on YouTube, then do check out our archive of past episodes and other podcasts here at Unbelievable, which explore the questions that matter to all of us. So let's dive into today's show with the top voted question. Will people who never get to hear about Christianity in their lives go to hell when they die?
Well, hi everyone. First of all, it's great to be here and thanks for coming to this heavy, heavy session beginning with hell on a Thursday afternoon in Minehead. So this is a classic question that really goes to the heart of the idea of whether God is just and whether the Christian faith is just. And it's a question that theologians and followers of Jesus have wrestled with for many generations. And at the heart of it is the idea, I think, saying, how could it be fair for God to judge people on the basis of something they didn't know? And if God were to do that, that would be really, really unjust. And the Bible presents God as a God who is both loving, a God of love, and a God of justice. And so that's the sort of crux of the question. So when it comes to Christian teaching on, or biblical teaching on hell, there are a variety of different views and opinions. I just want to sort of acknowledge that. But obviously I'm going to share what my view of what the Bible says about it. So to take the first question about justice, and then a little bit about what hell is and what it isn't, the question of who people who haven't heard, we could go to different places in Scripture, but I would probably want to have a look at the beginning of the book of Romans, where Paul sort of unfolds for us a theology of revelation and what theologians have called natural theology, this idea that God has kind of revealed himself in different ways. And the writer of the book of Hebrews picks it up as well. God has revealed himself through creation. God has revealed himself through the prophets. God has revealed himself then ultimately in the person of Jesus. And if we look at the book of Romans, we kind of have this sense of God actually judging people on the basis of what they have heard and what they do see. And so we're introduced to this idea of a God of justice who judges people justly and righteously on the basis of what they have known and seen. Now, given that we know then as Christians that we do need Jesus. We need Jesus to save us, to redeem us, to forgive us, because even the knowledge that we do have isn't enough to save us. Obviously, there is this gospel imperative and desire to get the cross of Christ and the offer of salvation through Jesus known to the world. It's not meant to reassure us that, you know, we don't need to worry about whether people are going to be judged or not because they've got natural theology. That the heart of the Romans teaching there isn't to say, you know, the cross doesn't matter. But there is very much this sense of God judging us on the basis of what we have heard. I think the second thing I would say is that we don't know how much people know. And I would draw on two practical examples that I found helpful in this regard. So I may think there's this whole group of people who've never had a missionary preach to the gospel to them. But that doesn't mean I know what God has revealed to them or not. There's a book that was a classic book when I was growing up called Eternity in Their Hearts, and it was a book of examples of unreached groups of people who had some sort of knowledge of the gospel of a God of love sending his son into the world without ever having had the Christian gospel preached to them. In other words, people who'd received some kind of revelation culturally or in other different ways that was very much, you know, the gospel as we understand it. A second example I would look at would be the story of Stalin's daughter. You'd think of Joseph Stalin as one of the most evil perpetrators of crime and injustice and murder that we saw in the 20th century. But the story is told of him on his deathbed. And as he lies dying on his deathbed, he sits up in bed and he looks at heaven, looks at the ceiling, looks up, and, you know, is very sort of his face very much kind of engaged. And he shakes his fist at heaven and falls back into bed and dies. So who knows what we can make of that? But when you hear an example like that, what I think that tells me is that even someone like Stalin could have had an intervention by God on their deathbed. So when we talk about people who haven't heard, we don't actually know what people haven't heard and what they don't know. And so I think the Bible is trying to encourage us to view God as a God of justice. So there's a element of us being judged on the basis of what we do know. Also to bear in mind, we don't know what people have known and what direct revelation they may have received from God. So we also don't know that. And we also don't know what decision they made with that towards the end. And then to land on the teaching of Jesus in Matthew's gospel, where he encourages us as Christians not to put ourselves in the position of being the judge. So, you know, Jesus says to us, don't make that eternal judgment. It isn't on us. So Jesus does warn people that hell is real, that judgment is real, that when we die, we will face the judgment of a good and just and loving God. We will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. there is some kind of retributive justice and judgment in hell after we die, but it isn't for us to say who is in and who is out. We know we can be saved from that through the cross of Jesus Christ and his forgiveness for us. We know that God can reveal that to people through the preaching of the gospel, through direct revelation, through revelation in culture, through natural revelation, maybe even on people's deathbeds. But what we can't do is say that we know this or that or the other person is going to land in hell. So I think that's how I'd answer it. Sorry, it's a long answer.
No, that's good. The poll has actually changed, and now this is such a tricky topic, and obviously it can be framed in so many ways. And I'm aware I've got two doctors here who've probably seen a fair amount of death and really grappled with this question from a personal perspective. But the question is, if God is real, then why did my dad die of cancer when I was 11, even though my family prayed about it? Ben Thomas, do you want to go first?
Afternoon, everyone. Thanks so much for having us along. Really tough and sad question here. And I think firstly, what I would like to say is that for anyone here who has had this experience or is currently going through this experience, God cares about your suffering. God cares about the suffering that has happened to you, to your loved ones. We see it throughout the Bible that God cares for us, and he cares for a world that is broken. The next thing that I would say is the suffering is to an extent a mystery. We don't exactly know why things happen to us and the particular things that happen at particular times. We don't know why those things happen. And Jesus is very clear about that, asking in questions in the book of John, when people say, oh, yeah, why did this thing happen to this person? Is it a result of their sin or something else? And Jesus says, no, these things didn't necessarily happen because of sin or anything like that. It is because we live in a broken world. And we, of course, you go back to the book of Genesis and you see that God did make the world perfect, but then a terrible thing happened in the fall, and that death and suffering and physical illness and mental illness and lostness and confusion and all those, you know, terrible things that many of us struggle with in different ways has come into the world. But the next thing that I would say, just in terms of hope, there is that God, of course, hasn't left us in that place. He has come into our suffering in the person of Jesus, who suffered on our behalf. He knows suffering. He has been ahead of us in that, and that he has suffered. But firstly, to bring us back into relationship with him, because our sin had broken off that relationship, but also to bring an end to suffering and sin and death at the end. So that has a use-by date. Sin and death is going to end eventually. So we can have hope, we can grieve for these things, but we don't grieve without hope as Christians. I do note the bit there that said, you know, even when our family prayed about it. And I think there I would just want to say that, you know, there is significant pain in the reality of unanswered prayer. I've had it in my life. I'm sure many of you will have had it in your lives too, that the pain of unanswered prayer is very real. But I just challenge a couple of things there, is that God arguably doesn't leave any prayer unanswered, but he doesn't necessarily give us the answer that we're looking for. And for me, the book of Job has been really helpful in this. So the book of Job, I'm sure many of you know it, in terms of Job, he went through significant suffering. What we see at the beginning is that God actually has a chat with Satan. And Satan kind of, you know, wants to bring suffering, and God does let that happen. But there's a whole discussion there that Job is not aware of. And it's to say that really we live in a physical world, but there is a very real spiritual world there where things are going on that we don't understand and we can't understand. So for me, again, I think I can say in my experience of having seen this as a doctor that we see, that I see and I believe that God is real, but just because we pray, it doesn't necessarily mean that God will heal us, will heal our relatives, will bring us back in this world. But what we have seen is that God promises that he will bring all suffering and sin and death to an end at the end, whenever that is. So I think in summary, what I would say is that God does never promise us that we will all be healed and that we won't die, that we won't have physical illness. Unfortunately, that is a reality of the broken world that we live in. But Jesus has come into that. He has suffered before us and he is going to bring suffering and death to the end, to an end at the end of time as we know it. And that we should still pray to God for these things. We should still ask him for healing, but it's also about trusting him when that answer comes back as a no, and being able to be in community and grieve that together when those answers come as a no. It's very painful, but Jesus is with us in that, and so should our Christian community be. So let's try and be Jesus to each other in those suffering moments. That's all I want to say for now.
Thank you, Ben. Just jump in on a couple of those points. One is, why did my dad die of cancer? I mean, that question of why is massive, isn't it? In fact, you know, the story in the Bible of where Lazarus, the brother, has died, and Martha says to Jesus, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died." I'm sure everyone in this room has found ourselves in a similar situation, saying to God, if you had done something, if you'd cared enough, if you had done a miracle, then this suffering wouldn't have happened. And the fact that that is articulated in the Bible, it's right through the Old Testament, then as well during the ministry of Jesus, that we are not alone in asking this question, and the Christian faith is not afraid of this question. Why did this happen? Ben's touched on the story in the book of Genesis about Adam and Eve, but within Christian philosophy, that's called the free will defense. And I think it is worth us as Christians understanding that a little bit. What that essentially means is that God is loving and God has created human beings in his image. And that means that we have certain capacities. One of those capacities is to make decisions, to make choices, unlike other animals, right? We've got conscience and we've got the capacity to have a will. But one of the other things about us as human beings is that we have the capacity to love. So God makes a good world within which human beings have the capacity and possibility of love. Now, the possibility of love does entail certain danger. The possibility of love means that we have and have to be able to make free choices. When I was 15, I was living in Birmingham. My dad was a vicar in an inner city parish there. And I had a friend who was also 15 who found herself in a situation where her family arranged a marriage for her with someone she'd never met. And the person she was due to marry actually lived in the home country of her grandparents. So this arranged marriage was going to go ahead, and my friend was terrified. I remember the conversations with her, and I remember her saying, I feel like I want to have some choice about who I love and sleep with and, you know, all of that, and end up getting married to. And I feel like being forced into this arrangement is the opposite of love. And she actually had really good reason to be afraid. Her cousin had been in the same situation the previous month, and had decided to run away, and the relatives had actually found where she was in the city and knocked her down with a car. It was very dramatic. So my friend, age 15, is saying, I feel like love and choice go together, and having my choice removed actually impacts my possibility of love. Now, friends helped her get to a safe house. She was later reconciled with her parents. The forced marriage didn't go ahead. But I remember as a teenager
deeply thinking about that, and it struck me that that is reflective of a Christian view of love. God makes a world in which love is possible. That's a world in which, as human beings, we're given the possibility of choice. That's what we see with Adam and Eve. But Adam and Eve have used their choice, as we have as human beings, to harm as well as to love. And the Bible's explanation of why there's cancer, why good people die young, why there's tragedy, why there's other sorts of disease, is rooted in our history as human beings, that we've used our capacity to love to harm as well as to do good. And so that's called the free will defense. In other words, cancer, death, violence, even natural evil, the evil and suffering that we see around in the world are not God's design, but they're here as a consequence of our exercise of choice. So you may not say that to a person who's thinking, why did my dad die when I was 11? But I think it's helpful for us as Christians to understand that that's how the Bible even positions this possibility of suffering, but God still being loving in this world.
Yeah, and I agree with all that's been said. Just one small point that I just want to add to this, and that is that as Christians, we believe in a God who can and does work through suffering for good.
There's been so many brilliant questions, so thank you so much for being so vulnerable in all your questions, guys. Ben Thomas, it won't surprise you that at the top is a question about homosexuality. I'm just going to read the question then, if you're okay, to just have a go at this. Has the church historically got it wrong about sexuality being gay? And do you think in decades to come, same-sex relationships will be fully accepted?
Wow, that's a ding-donger, isn't it? Okay. Thank you for that question. Really, really important topic to be discussing in the church. I am sure that there will be people who have different viewpoints in this audience. I'm going to come to it with my own story. And then I think as a result of that, hopefully I will be able to give my answer to the question. Just a little bit about my testimony. I went to church growing up, but it never occurred to me that it was true. It just seemed a bit like a kind of a social construct and a way to kind of wind away your Sunday mornings, because not a lot else was happening at the time. I remember going to university, went to med school, which is a relief to many of you, given that I'm a doctor. I didn't get the degree off eBay.
What, you went to med school?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You should go. So I went to med school and I met these people. I remember thinking at the time, these guys are Christian nutcases, because they actually seem to believe that it's true. And so I started, but purely out of interest, really, and just to slightly humour them, to actually read scripture for myself. And I read about the person of Jesus and about Christianity, and it seemed to make a lot of sense to me and to really describe the world as I saw it and experienced it. But what I also saw was the passages that were written about homosexuality. And that was particularly powerful to me, because since probably about the age of 5, I had realised that I had a very powerful kind of relationship and attraction to men that I didn't do to women. Now, of course, when you're 5, that's not sexually or romantically expressed, but as I went through into puberty and into my teenage years, it certainly did. And I had a couple of girlfriends, because it was in the 90s at that stage when being gay was really not cool at all. The relationships with those poor ladies went extremely badly, so please pray for them. But I realised that it wasn't a phase, and that essentially I was gay. And then that led to a kind of a 10-year thing of me keeping God at arm's length, because I liked the person Jesus. There was a lot of relevance and things that I saw in Christianity, and yet I knew that there was something inside of me that God didn't seem to like, and I wondered, does God love me? Does God really want to be in relationship with me? Sort of how does that work? And then I'd about 10 years got into a few relationships with men, and then there was one time in sort of 2009 when my boyfriend at the time went to go and work abroad and for a few months. And at that point I was like, right, okay, I need to get this sorted, because I'm kind of leading this life that I'm not really sure what I think about God. And so I started to look at all the big questions that maybe many of us will have asked about the Christian faith. So can we trust the Bible? Is it actually this bigoted and homophobic text that has its sexual ethics are just utterly out of date? What about even the idea of God? Can we entertain that in a world of science where, you know, has that answered all our sort of questions? What about other faiths? What about suffering? And so I looked at all these things. And I also read the different takes that people have on same-sex relationships and how God feels about them. And I looked at the traditional law, what we call the orthodox sexual ethic, which is that God has given marriage between one man and one woman exclusively, and that anything expressed sexually outside of that is sin. And then the more liberal or progressive view that is being articulated in this question, that actually God does approve and sanction and has designed same-sex relationships. And my two conclusions that I'll leave with you now is that you won't be surprised to know that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and that has massively transformed my life. And so I came to know actually that he was true, but also that he loved me and that he loves every single person who has ever existed, regardless of what identifiers they may use for themselves. So there is no one in this room, no one in your families, no one in this world who is not loved by God and made in his image. So regardless of who it is, all people, straight, LGBT plus, are all loved and adored by God, and he celebrates over every single one of us and is so glad that we are created. In fact, as my colleague Sam says, God was having a good day when he created you. And so that is what I came to know and experience for myself. But to my disappointment, actually, at the time, I came to the conclusion that the traditional or orthodox sexual ethic, as it has historically been taught in the Bible, actually made the most sense to me in terms of what I was reading in Scripture. And so that I decided and made the call that actually I needed to finish the relationship with my boyfriend, and I became a Christian. So I did that. I'd kind of got mentally convinced by it, but then came the relational element and actually coming to love Jesus and be involved in his love for me and live on a day-by-day basis for him. And so I ended that relationship, and that was painful. But I, over the last 13 years, it's not been a sinless walk by no means. There have been difficulties along the way. But what I have experienced is that singleness is not the kind of the pariah or makes you the pariah of the Christian community or indeed the human community. That there are benefits and beauties in marriage and having kids, but there are also benefits and beauties in singleness. There is difficulty in marriage and there is difficulty in singleness. But what we see through the Bible and particularly in the New Testament is that marriage and singleness are both held up together as being really valid ways of following Jesus. But what is really important to know that I have realized is that God doesn't want any one of us to be without being known and being without intimate, lovely, God-boundaried relationships and friendships. And I have discovered that for myself. I have much better, closer, deeper friends now than I ever did when I was living life with my boyfriends. I would also go to Mark chapter 10, where Jesus gives a promise, and he says that those who give up their lives in various different ways, their relationships, their family relationships, whatever it may be, who give that up for the gospel, will not fail to receive 100 times as much in this generation and also eternal life to come. And I can testify here that God has been very good to me in that. It's evidence he's got a sense of humour, because although I don't have a wife and kids, I do have 6 godchildren, which is quite frankly getting ridiculous. And it's an expensive business. So if any one of you thinks about that, just check your bank balance before you kind of get involved with that. But I have 6 godchildren, and it's an absolute pleasure to be involved in their lives. I'm involved in 4 families now where I've been given what I call fridge rights, which is basically where you can go to their fridge and you can take stuff out of it without being arrested. You can really be involved in their families. So I have experienced that when you give up your life for God, he does honor that. And actually, I just want to end with this maybe and let other people come in, because I've been yapping on for a while, that this is what we are all called to. It is not saying that those who are LGBT plus identifying are called to this hideous life of repression and not being known and not having any kind of fun or friendship or relationship. We are all called to deny ourselves. We are all called to pick up our cross, and we are all called to follow Jesus, regardless of whether we are straight or LGBT plus, however you wish to identify yourself. So my answer to the question is, has the church got it wrong historically on that in terms of the historical Orthodox doctrine? No, I don't think it has. Where the church has got it wrong, I think sometimes, is in really not hearing and seeing and listening to those of an LGBT plus orientation and realizing that the struggle and the difficulty there. There, I think there have been some mistakes that the church has made and continues to make. But have we got it wrong in terms of the Orthodox traditional sexual ethic? No, I don't think we have. I've seen real blessing and joy and life in doing it myself. It's not been, as I say, not been a sinless walk, and I'm not perfect at it. And also, it's not easy. But then, marriage is not easy here. Put your hands up if you're in a marriage that is really easy. Oh, you are. Oh, well done, sir. Okay, excellent. Very good. Many congratulations. Everyone go and see this chap afterwards, because he's got all the answers. But we are all in difficult relationships, but also with a mix of blessing. And that is what I have experienced in my life. And so that would be my answer.
Ben, thank you so much for sharing. I know it's not easy. We really appreciate your vulnerability and your sacrifice. And thank you for sharing so wonderfully. Other Dr. Ben.
I would also echo that. It is an amazingly brave and inspiring thing to share something so personal in public. So thank you. You said that the church has made mistakes in the past when it comes to this. I would go further. I think there have been some appalling acts of discrimination and prejudice, and in some cases just blatant abuse when it comes to this issue of same-sex attraction. And I do think there's a lot of repentance that does need to be done in the church on this issue.
We are so grateful for Ben Thomas's openness and vulnerability to share his personal story and experience of working through this really difficult question firsthand. If you want to delve deeper into these topics of sexuality and identity, then do visit livingout.org for a whole heap of resources, books, and videos tackling this very personal, sensitive, and important question. We're going to take a quick break before the panelists answer some more questions, but we'd also love to hear from you. What are your questions? Drop us a tweet on X at Premier Unbelievable FE, or drop us a direct message on Instagram and Facebook at Premier Unbelievable. Or if you're on TikTok and have questions, then on there we're at premier.unbelievable. We'll be back in just a moment.
Before we get back to this episode, I just want to take a moment to remind you that this podcast is only possible thanks to the support of listeners like you, which makes your gift today so important. That's why, to thank you for your generous gift today, I'd like you to have a copy of a new ebook from N.T. Wright called What Do We Mean by Heaven? The Resurrection of Jesus and the Rapture. This new ebook offers profound biblical answers to questions about salvation, the resurrection, the afterlife, and the rapture. As you uncover the important answers, you'll also be encouraged and challenged to find peace and hope in the deep mysteries of life. Again, it's our thanks for your gift to help more people live as confident, informed Christians today. To give your gift and download your copy of the N.T. Wright ebook, What Do We Mean by Heaven? The Resurrection of Jesus and the Rapture, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the Unbelievable podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Let's dive back into today's Q&A show with our panellists, Dr. Emil Ewing, Dr. Ben Chang and Dr. Ben Thomas. Our strapline for this live event was no questions off limit, and we received a number of questions about the character of God. So, is God a genocidal villain? Let's find out.
This has got a lot of likes. I mean, not a like, but as in people want to talk about it. So thumbs up, that's what we'll go with. When God flooded the world, wouldn't there be a lot of innocent people who had died, at the very least babies and children? Why weren't they saved? And I suppose this goes to the heart of what many, many, many people would ask about, the things that go on in God's name, you know, perhaps biblical accounts of genocide, that kind of things. How do we answer some of those questions where it really looks like innocent people are being destroyed, particularly at the hand of God, something that God has ordained?
So just a couple of general comments about the Old Testament, and then to talk specifically about Noah's flood. So general comment about the Old Testament. As Christians, unless any of us are Jewish, either by family tradition or genetics, really the only reason we would read the Old Testament at all is because of Jesus. And it's really important to remember that. There is an Old Testament, but we only read it because of Jesus and then through the lens of the New Testament, and there did need to be a New Testament. So the Bible presents itself as an unfolding revelation that occurs through history and that progresses, okay? And then you have two things going on between the Old Testament and New Testament. You have continuity and discontinuity. So there is continuity between the Old and New Testament in the sense of God is God. God is a God of love. He's a God of justice. God is revealing himself. There's prophecies of the deliverer that's going to come. There's going to be a Messiah. Then there is a Messiah, and so on. But there is also discontinuity between the Old and New Testament. In other words, the Old Testament contains stories of a period of time that actually comes to an end or comes to a fulfillment in the person of Jesus. So when we read actually any stories about God's judgment in the Old Testament, we read them through the lens of the Redeemer, the Messiah, Jesus, who has come and who did need to come. We did need to be saved. The world did need to be saved. And God has actually done it and revealed himself ultimately through Jesus and Christ on the cross. We also, though, in the New Testament are still operating with a framework of a God who, because he is good, is also just. Because he is loving, also does judge evil. And again, at the cross of Christ, that's one of the things we see. Jesus bears not just the sins of the world, expiation, carrying your sin off you onto himself. He also carries the judgment of God for sin. Propitiation is the theological word. So he takes the penalty as well as the sin itself. And sometimes for us, or sometimes as Christians, we maybe struggle with that idea of God's justice or his judgment being actually good. And I want to just dwell here for a second to dig into this together for a moment, because we're now actually living in a cultural moment where there's a generation crying out for justice. A generation who is saying abuse and harm actually matter greatly. And is there any framework that is going to acknowledge the seriousness of harm? I really saw this myself in my early 30s. My husband and I were living, my husband's was a pastor at the time, leading a church in the inner city in a really difficult neighborhood of London. And we come to know and a woman in the community who was the same age as me. I think I was actually 29, so not even 30, but she's the same age as me. She'd come to gloriously know the Lord, but had a really different life from me. She had five children that each of those men had abused her in some way, left her. She was coping amazingly, actually raising a family. She came to know Jesus gloriously and was serving him. And her oldest daughter, who was a young teenager, was part of the youth ministry of the church. And then various things happened. One of her ex-partners was released from prison and came. She had a restraining order, but came to the flat and assaulted her child, her oldest child, and nearly killed my friend, left her for dead. And she nearly lost one of her eyes. She was very horrifically assaulted. And I saw her the next day. So this is someone that I've walked with, someone that I love. This is a courageous woman who's raising a family in really difficult circumstances. and she was unrecognizable. And as I laid eyes on her and I looked at her with love, was my impetus, was the feeling in my heart, oh, her abuser should get off scot-free? Is that what love sees when they see someone harmed and damaged? No. Actually, what I felt in that moment was my heart cries out for justice for this woman, and this guy needs to be caught and he needs to pay a penalty for the crime. In other words, in that situation, I was able to see how judgment and love actually exist together. Now, the Bible presents the picture of a God who, because he is loving, is also just. He calls abusers, those who cause great evil and harm in this world, to account. In the Old Testament, one of the means of that judgment is in this story, the story of Noah's flood. Now, what's interesting is that in the midst of that story, so God ultimately judges the world for acts of evil and great harm that has occurred. God ultimately judges by bringing this flood. What is interesting is the process of God's revelation, even in that judgment. In other words, Noah spends time building the ark and explaining to people why he's building the ark. Noah invites people to come into the ark. And ultimately, after a period of time when the flood begins, you know, actually, if you look at the dimensions of the ark, biblical scholars argue there was masses of space, there was loads of space for people. So even as God is judging evil, judging harm, which is an iteration of his love, the two go together. We've explored that a little bit together. This kind of means of God's judgment happens within this limited time frame that has come to an end now because Jesus has come. But even in that kind of story, there's still grace. There's space in the ark. There's the preached message of the prophet Noah and the opportunity to respond. And then just the last thing I would say as well about the text. The Hebrew word used where we describe, where we would think of the flood of the whole world, the Hebrew word is haaretz, the land. And that is the same form of words that is used later for the promised land. So some biblical scholars would make a case that this is a flood that is over the whole land, not over the whole world. And so there's a possibility that that's actually the interpretation of the text there. So are people caught up in this judgment? Are people caught up in this natural disaster who are young, who are children? Yes. The Bible does actually describe the world as you and I know it and experience it, where earthquakes, famines, natural evil, we could spend a whole load of time talking about that as well, affect all sorts of people. In other words, a wide scale of people are harmed because of the selfish and evil harm perpetrated by the individuals who are ultimately being judged. So the Bible is an unfolding revelation. There's continuity and discontinuity. We as Christians don't live in the Old Testament. There is grace even in a story like that. And there's also the possibility that we're not actually talking about a global flood, that haaretz is actually a more limited kind of space. So the scale of people impacted by this is much less.
I very much agree with what Amy said. The flood is meant to be horrifying. It's meant to be awful because it was a righteous act of judgment on the wickedness of the people. And we see in 2 Peter that the flood was actually a foreshadowing of the ultimate judgment day. And so we read these narratives and we're meant to be shocked by just how awful this judgment was. I think it's mad that Noah's Ark has become a children's story because it's awful. It's horrifying. And these questions are, this is a very interesting question about the children and stuff, but I do think we shouldn't lose sight on the point that we're meant to be taking home from this. And that is the seriousness of God's judgment because of the seriousness of sin. Mm. Just a little kind of medical anecdote. So in your first year of becoming a doctor, you have a provisional license. And there are certain things you can't do as a first year qualified doctor. And one of the things you can't do is prescribe chemotherapy drugs. And there's an obvious reason for that. And that's because chemotherapy drugs are really dangerous drugs. They have awful side effects. And if they're not given correctly, they can be lethal. These are really dangerous drugs that you have to be working as a doctor for more than 1 year to prescribe. Now, what are we doing prescribing these really, really dangerous substances? Well, the answer is, of course, because they treat something that is even worse, that is even more awful, cancer. Yeah. And if that's the treatment, how bad must the problem be? If this is the judgment that God administers on the people in Noah's era, if this is the righteous judgment of God, how bad must the problem of sin be? And I think that's the point we need to take away from this passage. These questions are good and interesting and worth talking about, but the point, I think, is that sin is serious and we need to take it seriously.
Such a big question, and I'm so grateful to our panelists today, Dr. Emil Ewing, Dr. Ben Chang, and Dr. Ben Thomas. I do hope that this episode has got you thinking and maybe begun to answer some of your own difficult questions. For more debates and discussions featuring thought leaders like Jordan Peterson, John Lennox, and Alex O'Connor, as well as more insights from Emil Ewing, do head over to our YouTube channel or our website, premierunbelievable.com. In upcoming episodes, we'll be exploring questions like, is there any evidence for the resurrection? Is Christianity just a psychological crutch? Does the Bible condone slavery? Are Christian moral values relevant in our modern context? Is the Bible sexist? And what about AI? If you've enjoyed today's show, then please don't forget to hit the subscribe button, like and share this episode, and do follow us on social media for all of the latest updates. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next week.